Welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Matt Taibbi.
I'm Katie Alper.
And also farewell to Useful Idiots.
Well, not really.
Not really. So we have an announcement.
Drum roll, please.
We're no longer going to be in this space. Rolling Stone and Useful Idiots are parting ways. We don't have to get into the details of why exactly that is, but this is our 80th episode, and we're not going to stop. We're going to continue doing the show. It's just going to move to a new home. It's going to usefulidiots.substack.com. We'll be able to give you more information about that, but it looks like we're going to keep on the same schedule, so you can expect a show to
drop every week. Yes.
Exactly. Yeah, until YouTube, the end of time.
Until the end of time. If you feel lost, just go to usefulidiots.substack.com. And yeah, it's going to be the same great show at the same great time, just not sponsored by the same great outlet.
That's right. Yeah. We said with a smile. So,
And thanks to Rolling Stone for the ride. It's
It's been great. We're all entering new stages in our lives.
Yes. Matt, would you like to share the other stage you entered?
Yeah. I mean, I'm older.
Yeah, you circled around the world one more time.
That's right. That's right. I just turned 51 this week. So I've been too old for the club. I looked it up. Apparently, the maximum age to be in the club is 37.
What's the club?
You know the whole expression, like too old. He's too old for the club.
Oh no, I didn't know about that. Well, I don't accept that cutoff.
You don't? Okay. Well.
Well, because I would cut me. I'm not going to say anything, but that may not include me.
Right.
I know I look no more than 25, but yeah.
Yeah, not a day older. Look, it was just a day like any other day, but the one great surprise was that you made a video for me.
I did make a video. Do we have that?
Just as a preface, part of the joke here is that, you know, this is obviously a two-person show, and, in every professional pairing, there has to be a leader and a follower. There has to be a number one and a number two. And so this birthday message is for number two. Ooh, everyone wants to be number one. True. Ooh, yeah.
It's much better being number two. And then it says, happy birthday. You're the S*T.
How much original work was there in that?
If I didn't respect you so much, I would lie and say that there was a lot of elbow grease put into that. But the truth is, there's an app called Jib Jab.
Uh-huh, right.
And I did pick that, and I dragged your face into it.
It's
and
fine.
A lot of thought went into it, and you know, but yeah, it's an app.
Is that the same Jib Jab that did the famous John Kerry versus Bush?
Probably, yeah. I think it started out that way, and then they turned it into an app. It's really great, actually. You should you can use it for lots of different things.
I'll have to check it out. Anyway, I appreciate it.
That was
very nice. So
sure, I tweeted it out.
Yeah, very happy to be number two with you. So, look, this is our last show.
It's not our last show. Hold on. It's our last Rolling Stone show.
Right. It's our last Rolling Stone show, and it's a good one. We have a guest, Stella Morris, who is, how would you describe Stella?
She is a barrister and also happens to be the life partner of Julian Assange. And they met when she was working on his case. They have had two children, and as she gets into during the interview, there was a lot of obstacles to their having children.
Unique ones.
Yeah, not your regular drama, not your regular boy meets girl, rather boy meets girl
under heavy surveillance.
It's a really important story, and I think the personal side of it is important because Assange is so vilified and smeared, and it's an important reminder that, you know, politics aside, and I think it's a very black and white case, the guy should not be in jail, extradited. I think it's an important thing to just remind people that this is a human being and that almost everything you've heard about him that's negative is either not true or not confirmed.
Right?
Like,
well, yeah, right. Yes, that's probably true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or I'll just say, like, none of the reasons that people think that he's being punished have nothing to do with, technically, have nothing to do with 2016.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that the prevailing legends about him are not true.
Right.
You know, yeah. But yeah, no, the case is amazing, and she goes into really tremendous detail about it. So we're going to talk to her in a bit.
Yeah.
Well, let's just get to it. The four food groups. I guess I'm up for Democrats suck.
Yeah.
I was going to go with the whole thing about the parliamentarian,
Yeah.
canceling the minimum wage thing, because there's a couple of things about that
Yeah.
that are first of all, it's kind of malodorous to me. Like, I don't think the Democratic leadership really wants to have
Course
a
not. Yeah.
$15 minimum
No.
wage. So, you
If they
know,
did, they could do what Republicans have done in the past, which is ignore it, ignore the
well,
parliamentarian, or fire the parliamentarian,
yes,
or not
multiple.
leak ahead of time. I mean, come on.
Right.
They mentioned ahead of time they didn't think it was going to work. Come on.
Yes, and the parliamentarian's ruling is a recommendation, not a law. It depends on how you want to look at it. But
Right.
I just wonder if there are other shenanigans afoot. Like, wouldn't it be great if we could just vote for this thing, but then have it be killed by the parliamentarian like that? But we decided not to go with that.
But
And
just one thing before we move on from that, we want to give a shout out to and moment of silence for
oh,
Tira Nandon.
for Tir Nandan, yeah.
Yeah.
And what we're gonna do is we're gonna have a This is a moment of gloating silence.
Yeah.
We're gonna gloat for 10 seconds,
Yeah.
and that's it. This is the
That's
last
it.
time we're not ever gonna mention it again. So let's start now.
Okay.
Ready?
Go.
All right.
All
So that was
right,
good. That
great.
was
That was
10 seconds
good.
of gloating. Let's start with Democrats suck. We've got what I think is the ultimate example
My God,
of
so
it.
great. Let's take it away. Yeah.
Elvis, if we could see this,
Go to the
the
videotape.
MSNBC clip here. This is the former CIA director, John Brennan.
Talking to former Bush spokeswoman Nicole Wallace. And of course, both of these people definitionally are parts of our major fixtures on MSNBC.
Well, I must say, to Claire's point, I'm increasingly embarrassed to be a white male these days, and what a light of what I see of my other white males saying. But it just shows that with very few exceptions, like Mitt Romney, Liz Cheney, Adam Kinzinger, there are so few Republicans in Congress who value truth, honesty, and integrity. And so they'll continue to gaslight the country the way that Donald Trump did. And the fact that this has such security and safety implications for the American public and for the members of Congress, again, as Claire said, it is just a disgusting display of craven politics that really should have no place in the United States in 2021.
There's three funny things in there. The least funny being that he used the word gaslight. Like,
Gaslighting. I mean,
yeah.
that's amazing. Yeah.
The other one is that this is a guy who perjured himself to Congress, talking about there being an insufficient number of people dedicated to truth and honesty. And
Well,
then,
he would know because he's not part of that group,
I guess so.
right? Yeah.
And then the idea that somebody who oversaw a drone assassination program, torture, rendition, secret prison network, and mass surveillance, that what he's embarrassed by is being a white male.
He's not that embarrassed, apparently, to back all sorts of things, as you pointed out, Matt. And I didn't hear him like complaining about, something we haven't spoken about, no one's spoken about at all, and it's really disgusting, is the whole Syria bombing thing.
Oh, yeah,
I mean,
it just happened. Yeah.
it just happened, and like I thought there was a return to normal, which meant like I thought there was diplomacy. I thought we were celebrating normal stuff.
Now,
Anyway,
this is part of the whole formula of Clintonian politics. It's
right.
like getting your car registration. You have to bomb somebody like once a year. It doesn't have to be a big thing. It
Right.
doesn't have
Yeah,
to
you don't have to
be.
make it ser Yeah, you keep it so it's like he has decorum when he does it,
Right.
Biden. Yeah. So I guess sorry, I brought that up. That was kind of unconnected, but I think when I saw that, I was like, I'm just reminded he as a CIA guy has overseen so much violence.
Also, the whole tradition of the CIA
I know.
is it's a whole bunch of like white dudes
I
who
know.
were in the Skull
Yeah,
Society,
that's what he should be embarrassed by. He should
you
be embarrassed that
know.
he was in the CIA and Skull and Bones, and
I don't
yeah,
know if he
that's what he should
I
be
don't know if
embarrassed.
he personally was in
Well, he's
Skull
a
and
Skull and
Bones.
Bones adjacent.
Yeah.
Whatever.
So
Yeah. I mean,
anyway,
be embarrassed about being in the CIA. Then you can check your white male privilege, but why don't you start with the more structural problems with your
right.
biography, John?
And I don't know whether he technically qualifies as a Democrat. I mean, he did vote for Gus Hall, the communist, once. In 1976. But
wait, why and how?
It's a long story. You have to read his book is quite odd on that subject. But now he's like a bona fide member of the hashtag resistance. So I think he qualifies.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah.
What do we have for Republicans?
Okay, so Republicans suck. We have a kind of refreshing. This is almost like Republicans are awesome or Republicans rock.
How many times has this happened to us?
I know, it happens
show.
All the time. So this is reading on NBC News. In Supreme Court, GOP attorney defends voting restrictions by saying they help Republicans win. So if you scroll down, I'll just read. This is pretty amazing. An attorney for Arizona's Republican Party offered a blunt reason for his presence defending the state's voting restrictions before the Supreme Court on Tuesday. The measures disadvantage Democrats. So the Supreme Court is hearing arguments over Arizona voting restrictions in a pair of consolidated cases challenging a state law banning ballot collection and a policy that tosses ballots cast in the wrong precinct. Democrats have sued, saying the rules discriminate against minorities and violate Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. The case could have big implications outside of Arizona if the justices create a test for how to evaluate such voting rights cases under the voting rights legislation. And here's the really interesting part. So Justice Amy Coney Barrett, or what do we call her?
Harry Conehead.
Harry Conehead said, "What's the interest of the Arizona RNC in keeping, say, the out-of-precinct ballot disqualification rules on the books?" And Michael Carvin, the lawyer defending the state's restrictions, said, "Because it puts us at a competitive disadvantage relative to Democrats. Politics is a zero-sum game, and every vote they get through unlawful interpretation of Section 2 hurts us. It's the difference between winning an election 50-49 and losing an election 51-50. So, I don't know. I guess it's, like, refreshing. Yeah, they pretend that there are reasons other than electoral victory.
Or that you win cases based on legal reasoning.
Right.
Like, I actually, this is an interesting new kind of legal theory, like, you know, honesty.
Right. Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
Yeah. Your Honor, my argument is going to be one of that has no legal basis, but I'm just going to be straight with you here. We want this because it helps us.
It helps us win. Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, the interesting thing about this is, like, for things like this, it doesn't matter if the intention is racist or discriminating, I guess. It's whether the outcome is. So I wonder what he would say to that. I don't know how you talk your way out of it. Is it just like there should be precedent. Electoral victory trumps voting rights.
Well, I'm sure they're going to argue that the votes are illegitimate themselves. I mean, they must be arguing that there's no way.
Cool if they didn't, though. What if they were like, no, they're legal. We just got to get rid of them.
Well, not even that they're legal, but that they're actual people who would be legally allowed to vote, right?
Yeah.
If that were not the case, that would be really, really that would be ballsy.
Yeah.
You know. Either way, it's pretty good.
Yeah. And of course, the real Republican suck is, like, Texas opening everything up again and removing a mask mandate, or not mandate, whatever their mask thing is. So people are going to die. I'm not vindictive against Texans, just, like, against their politicians who have voted for this. And they should all be put in a room with a rotting COVID corpse and injected with COVID. That's my screenplay, not something I'm
advocating. You don't have anything against Texans, but you just want that.
No, not civilians, not the people who are at the just living the circumstances that they've been dealt by having these people in power. I'm just saying, I would like Ted Cruz to be in a coffin. This is my, but not. I'm not saying because he's dead. He should be alive when he's put in the coffin, and we can check on him and make sure he's still alive, and then we just put a COVID corpse in there with him. And, you know, because he has a lot of
grit. Then when he actually does die, I'll
be so sad.
Well, okay. I was going to go somewhere else with that.
Coming. Yeah. Our fans are going to want one last necrophilia discussion, I'm sure, but we'll try to work it in later.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I understand completely your feelings about Texans in that regard.
Not Texans, but Texan Republicans and whatever complicit Dems and Abbott, Greg Abbott and Ted Cruz. I want them together in a coffin with a rotting COVID corpse.
With a rotting COVID corpse.
I mean, I'm being very generous and charitable. I'm not calling on anyone to harm them. I'm just, I have some sleeping arrangement suggestions, demands.
That's right.
Demands for them.
It's kind of a Three Stooges sort of, a, right? Yeah. I get it. Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, that's the Republican sucks. So for Isn't That Weird, at first the story is, this is from the UPI, carpool lane driver found to be using mannequin passenger. First of all, for those just listening, it's a pretty good looking mannequin. It's got realistic eyes, glasses. It's got a Cleveland Indians cap and a COVID mask on.
The face is old. And then has kind of like hipster glasses and like a hipster
little hair. Yeah.
Yeah. Look, one of the advantages of COVID is that the face mask makes it a lot easier to have a dummy in your passenger seat.
Yeah. And when you're doing it in the HOV lane. And if you scroll down, there's a quote from the California Highway Patrol. The California Highway Patrol said a driver using the high occupancy vehicle lanes of a highway was found to actually be traveling alone, except for, quote, one of the best dummies police had ever seen. It says the officer soon discovered the apparent, quote, man sitting in the passenger seat of a truck was actually a highly realistic mannequin, complete with a COVID-19 face mask. And then again, there's a quote from the CHP talking about how impressed they were with this dummy. And so I wondered how frequently this happened. So I started looking up to see if there were similar stories about people being arrested with dummies. And then I found a local news story from our area in New York that is like a masterpiece of local news reporting. Oh. See if you can count the local news writing cliches in this piece at the beginning.
When the person riding shotgun isn't actually a person, well, life in the fast lane can take its toll. Even cops don't take the imposters too seriously.
What is that?
As they bust drivers for adding fake passengers to sneak into high occupancy lanes that require more than one. And now we have a new favorite fake whose identity will soon be revealed.
I'm not the first dummy to sit in this seat.
Oh my God.
Let's count down our favorite dummy, number 10.
All right, then they go on.
Yeah, so this inflatable
car. Oh, this is amazing. Wait, so this is like, they have like the evidence of the worst dummies? We got to watch this. It's not that long, is it?
Okay, it goes on for a while, but yeah.
Let's watch a couple. Can we see a couple?
Sure, yeah. The first one's clearly a sex doll, and she doesn't bring
that
up.
Oh, you see, I didn't even know that. I don't think she knows that.
She's not much to look at.
See?
This inflatable could be the cousin of an airbag.
No.
Number 9. At least Tilly, a styrofoam head from a beauty supply store, looked angelic with hangers for shoulders and stuffing for legs. Number 8. Just a head. Not just a head. Just a head. Propped up on a jacket. Number 7.
Oh my, this one's good. I like this one.
The cousin of Dora the Explorer, a trooper pulled the car over when he observed the passenger with huge, unblinking eyes.
That's cute.
Number 6.
Oh, this is good. I can't believe you don't want to watch this.
With her teddy belted in.
And I turn and I see a motorcycle cop and I just have this huge smile on my face.
Oh, she's...
So she got a $260 ticket. Number 5.
A
driver who works with plexiglass for a living built this plexiglass cutout. Number 4. She's a babe. Just don't ask her to step out of the car, ma'am.
One driver chose the bare bones approach.
Oh, God. Here we go.
Number
see the bare bones approach?
I know. That's good. I can't believe you almost denied us and our viewers of this.
But why bother to fake a passenger?
You can just dress up the seat with a cap and t-shirt.
I like that.
So bad, it's good. Which brings us to the new number 1 dummy. James Campbell was pulled over on the Long Island Expressway sitting next to this Wood in a hoodie. The deputy asked,
"Passenger, can I see some ID?" And I said, "Officer, I don't think so."
Campbell says the dummy's sister is down in his basement dressed in a tutu. He showed no remorse right after being ticketed.
I've been using it for months. I came home on the HOV lane.
He plans to use it again with a different outfit. Knock on wood.
Oh, excellent, CNN. Excellent, all right.
New York.
Didn't that kind of freaked me out, that guy who has a sister character to the wooden body in a hoodie. That
I'm sure there's all kinds of scenarios playing out in that basement.
I don't think she knew it was a sex toy at the beginning because I didn't know it was. What do you call it? A sex what? A sex...
It's an inflatable sex toy.
Sex doll. Sex doll, right?
Doll. Yeah.
Sex doll. I didn't know that. There's no way she knew that because if she had, it wouldn't have been number 10.
Probably
you know what I'm saying?
Not.
It would have been like number 1, or I bet you they wouldn't have even shown it if they knew that.
I mean, what does she think that mouth hole is for?
Is it, well, I think more interesting is that it's the top of a head. It's cut, isn't the top of the head cut off?
I'm not sure what that's for, but
maybe she thinks the mouth hole could just be a realism. Like they were just going for realism. That's fine. You know, there's no realistic artistic justification for having the top of the head cut off. So that's right. What I don't hate her for the other thing.
Right. I just love all the puns.
Oh my god!
You know the bare bones approach. Bare I'm bones. Not the first dummy to sit
oh
in
my
this
god, that
seat.
Was great.
Yeah, and life in the fast lane fast can lane, take yeah. its toll.
Toll. Yeah, that's good. It open. Yeah, it starts off so good.
Very good stuff.
Yeah,
so
you really
rode that one to the bitter end. That, or,
yeah.
I should have stayed in my lane.
You should have stayed in your lane. I'm glad I pushed you outside of your comfort lane by making you play the full video because. Because that was quite a ride.
Signing off. I'm Katie Halper, CNN News, New York. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm all revved up now after watching that.
You're revved up.
Yeah, I have one good one. Not to shift gears too abruptly, but let's move from weird to terrible. I'm gonna put the brakes on that one. On that story.
Let's carpool our resources.
Yeah. And... Okay. So.
Nice.
This is absolutely disgusting, disgusting story. And this is sent in. Thanks. Shout out to David L. Wind, as in WIND. And this is a story reported in Al Jazeera about a rooster fitted with a knife for an illegal cockfight in southern India has killed its owner, sparking a manhunt for the organizers of the event.
Oh, I thought that was for the rooster.
I know, me too. Apparently, the bird had a knife attached to its leg when it inflicted serious wounds to the man's groin as it tried to escape, police said on Sunday. The victim, Sangula Satish, 45, died from loss of blood before he could reach a hospital in the Karimgarh district of Telangana state last week. Okay, so Satish was hit by the rooster's knife in his groin and started bleeding heavily. Now, this is like the worst part. It's not okay. The article says the rooster was briefly held at the local police station before it was sent to a poultry farm.
To be eaten?
And then the cop says, we may need to produce it before the court. Is he joking or serious? He's not. Maybe he doesn't mean, that's okay. In which case, that's okay. It's still alive. But this is disgusting. I mean, it's very hard for me to feel bad for this guy. Maybe if he has kids or something, but yeah, these things are real. They're banned, but they're still common in rural areas of Telangana and certain states. It was so gross. Okay. Specially bred roosters have 7.7 centimeters or 3-inch knives or blades tied to their legs, and punters bet on who will win the gruesome fight. Battles continue until one contestant is either dead or flees, declaring the other rooster the winner. And thousands of roosters die each year in this. I mean, for me, that isn't that terrible is not that they killed, that a rooster killed his abuser. It's that they have these abusive cockfights. That's the terrible part. And maybe isn't that kind of a...
I guess, I mean, like, how do you distinguish between this and, you know, like the sort of Auschwitz-like parade of chickens that are probably going into a factory somewhere to have their faces and other parts sucked off to be turned into
Oh my God, you're gonna get in McNuggets. So much trouble with the ADL. They're going to come after us. Luckily, we're not for the Auschwitz. You can't. I mean, I'm fine with it, but you're gonna get in trouble from the ADL, and then if you retract it, you're gonna get in trouble from PETA. So
right.
I don't like factory farming. You're right. I should. In fact, I should celebrate every time a farmer is killed by a chicken. It doesn't happen enough. Not the farmer, the owner of the terrible company. You know, like, go grab your copy of Zephyr Teachout's book, break them up, and don't blame the farmers. Blame the big ag, big tech, big ag. What are the other ones I need to call out? There's some other big
pharma.
Big pharma. Yeah, look, again, I'm not calling for anyone to be harmed. I'm just saying if it's a rooster versus a person, and the person is an executive... I'm just going to say, I hope the rooster scratches. Let's just say it doesn't have to be fatal. I don't know how that would ever happen. I don't think executives visit the farms that they...
Right. I have to also say that if you're in the business of genetically modifying roosters to kill and then strapping knives on them...
Yeah.
Statistically, it has to happen.
Oh, probably. Yeah. It happened to another guy. Yeah.
Like that eventually they're going to, you know, you're going to have a knife driven through your groin by your own rooster.
Yeah. And they're still searching for the other 15 people involved in organizing the legal fight. And they could face charges of manslaughter, illegal betting, and hosting a cockfight. Last year, a man was killed when a blade attached to his bird's leg hit him in the neck. during a cockfight. The
old carotid artery cockfight injury.
And in 2010, a rooster killed its owner by slashing his jugular vein in West Bengal. Which, even me who sides with the rooster, that makes me, you know, I don't like these stories at all. I don't want anyone to die, any rooster to die. But put these people in a coffin with Ted Cruz. That's what
I'm saying. And a decaying COVID corpse?
A decaying COVID corpse, and actually with one of the roosters.
Right, but then it would get really messy really quickly.
You're right. That could be a death sentence for many people. Because
there'd
be
all these parts everywhere, Ted Cruz's beard probably wouldn't survive either.
I know, you know what? Up until you point that out, I thought it was a good idea, but now I'm realizing that the group coffin is not sanitary once you throw in a knife-wielding rooster.
Genetically modified.
If it were not genetically modified, maybe I'd be okay. Maybe it'll be okay.
An ordinary rooster with a knife attached to its
It could work. But once it's honestly the line is the genetic modification, and that's when you know you've gone too far. That's when you know your group coffin plan has gone too far. Your COVID coffin. Your Airbnb. Basically, I'm creating an intimate Airbnb for Ted Cruz and cockfight organizers.
If you could have a little like lipstick camera in there, you can make a good HBO show out of that. It would be like Taxicab Confessions, except there'd be no dialogue. It would just be squirming and struggling to breathe and that sort of thing.
They could talk. I bet Ted Cruz would get some words out.
He could.
Abbott. Have you noticed Greg Abbott? His S's. They're very. He says them like that.
Maybe it's like he's like a fan of noir movies or something like that. You know, kind of that bogey technique.
Oh, yeah. Does he say that with the S?
Yes.
I
remember the day well. Yeah. The Germans wore gray. You wore blue.
Why does he talk like he has something in his mouth, but he's not opening his teeth?
I don't know. He was cool, though.
Yeah, he married Lauren Bacall.
Yeah, I was just watching the big sleep the other day. So
Jewish, by the way, she was.
Lauren Bacall.
Mm-hmm. Her name was like Lauren like Patitsky or something, or Pukowski. I can't. What was it? You want to hear a really stupid joke since it's our last Rolling Stone app?
Sure.
It gets better. Don't worry. So who wrote the Yellow River?
The Yellow River.
Yeah.
I don't know.
IP Daily.
Oh, God.
Who wrote The Polish Milkman?
Who wrote The Polish Milkman?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I. Polititsky. And then who wrote The Russian Butcher?
I don't know. Who?
I. Ketchikakov.
Oh, God.
Okay, that's it.
It's so bad.
It's so good.
It's the whole humor that's so bad that's good.
Yeah, thing. It's like CNN. It's like that lady.
She sold it really well. You did too. Yeah. No,
it's okay. I called it home.
We put the same amount of hardcore effort into this last episode that we put into all of 79 previous episodes
combined. All right, so guys, I'm just gonna ease you into this because people have found it jarring. So we are now going to segue into an advertisement.
Yeah, put yourself in a different mental space and get ready for an advertisement, because we're going to talk about a podcast called True Underdog.
Mm.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
You want to talk about your Substack story?
Sure. Yeah. Just briefly. Last week there was a Twitter thread by a professor named Sarah Roberts, who is the co-leader and co-founder of the UCLA Center for Critical Internet Inquiry, whose stated goal is, quote, strengthening democracy through culture making. And she went in this tirade about Substack, which is obviously where I work. You work and. The thread is kind of amazing, and it's the reason I think it's worth talking about is because this is like becoming a thing now. There have been a number of features in places like the New Yorker, and the New York Times wrote about Substack, and there's this increasing like message that Substack is like, it's not just annoying, but it's dangerous. And so she wrote a series of tweets. The first one says, Substack is a dangerous direct threat to traditional news media, but more importantly, it's a threat to journalism. And here's her argument. Journalists make their name doing reporting. This is governed by norms and practices and by ethics. Flawed and not always achieved, true, but present and guiding what newsrooms do in every way, yes. People not inside journalism or media may not know the specifics, but they often have a nebulous sense that there are norms, independence, disclosure of compromise, editorial oversight, and vetting of the reporting. That's what makes them trust enough to buy or and read or watch. What's less obvious is when there is a reporter who makes her name in a newsroom. Traditional paper or fully online outlet then leaves for Substack or any analog, taking that name reputation earned from work done in the context I just stated. In this way, an investigative reporter who has earned her bona fides in a newsroom and under both strict editorial and journalistic principles has just cashed out and turned herself into an opinion writer. She likes it because she's finally got her independence from an editor. Please do not write or pay for Substack. I have to say it. I believe it's dangerous. Take heed. You read it here first. She actually went on to say quite a lot of other things, but the essence of this argument is that basically it's like a stolen valor thing. And she's clearly referring, I think, primarily to Glenn Greenwald and myself, mm-hmm. because not many of the Substack contributors kind of fit the description of investigative reporters who move to,
right.
to the Substack. The implication is that we got our reputations by, you know, forged in the furnace of mainstream media oversight, and then we just absconded with that, all that trust and credibility, and went to Substack to cash in. There's a couple of things that are offensive about this, but the subtext of this is that there's this whole reaction now to any implication that if you're not being supervised by a credentialed company mm-hmm. or by an editor, it's not real journalism. You know, this is actually a theme with that we're going to talk about with our guest too, Stella Morris, which is, you know, the reason people are going to places like Substack is because the standards that she's talking about, all those norms, those hallowed norms, have really not done so well in the last 20 years. I mean, there have been so many fiascos in traditional news media, you know, starting with the WMD episode and, you know, going forward, that people don't really have the same faith in traditional news media that they used to. And I think additionally, now there's another set of things that people are worried about that have to do with whether or not outlets are politicized or taking an editorial line. There's a lot of sort of homogenous content at the bigger papers, right? So everybody's kind of saying the same thing, and that can be on the left or the right. I worry about this because it's this whole idea that alternative media, which has already taken such a huge hit in the last 20 or 30 years, you know, thousands of newspapers have disappeared, right? About like roughly half the people who used to work in journalism no longer do. We lost about $35 billion worth of revenue. There are, you know, something like 1,500 communities in the country that don't have a local newspaper anymore. So all the content is being driven to these big, centralized, largely national news organizations. And it's consolidating more and more, and those news organizations are becoming more like each other all the time.
Right.
These days, it's hard to distinguish between Slate and Salon and Atlantic.
Right.
Not only are they swallowing up all these sort of smaller outlets, but they're becoming more like each other. So there's less and less. And so Substack is like a relatively small thing, and the backlash is just so odd. People are describing it as dangerous. It's like a little tiny piece of something, and it's just...
You point out in your response to it, which you wrote on the dangerous site of Substack, but you point out a couple of things, and one of them is just like, just to clarify, because this is like just a point of order, like you were not just an investigative reporter. You wrote books and you wrote op-eds and you're well known for calling Goldman Sachs, what, vampire squid? What?
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, so she didn't even do her homework. As you point out, Glenn started as a blogger. But like, so that's just, I'm just saying that because so much for like responsible journalism and responsible investigating and, you know, being able to separate your feelings from just the facts, ma'am. What's more dangerous than the argument that Substack is dangerous is the flip side of that argument, which is that corporate media is not dangerous. Like, that's just as dangerous to me, not to get too meta, but it really is. It's like, you don't have to worry, even though she says journalists make their name doing reporting. This is governed by norms and practices and ethics. And by ethics, flawed and not always achieved, true, but present and guiding what newsrooms do in every way, yes. No, that's not true. And that's why it's much more dangerous, because you read about WMDs or you read about Russiagate, and you don't bring to that critical eye that knows that this is like subjective opinion based. And that's so much more dangerous.
Absolutely. And the point she's trying to make about trust, she's got it exactly backwards, because yes, there are procedures that once existed.
Yeah.
That people felt like they could rely upon to make sure that certain things didn't happen. But the business has kind of thrown a lot of those procedures overboard.
Right.
I mean, if she worked in it, she'd know that once they started losing money in the 80s and 90s, the fact checkers were the first to go, right? And
right.
That's how things like Jason Blair happened. Like, you know, they still do it in places, but nowhere near with the rigor that they used to. And then the politics have become so much more intense. Like, you know, that's the reason the New York Times sat on important stories, you know, that
yes.
Because they didn't want to lose their intelligence sources.
Right.
So what happens over time is that audiences aren't stupid. They see that things don't turn out, that stories turn out not to be true, like the WMD story, like a lot of stuff, a lot of the Russiagate stuff. And then they learn about things that stories that were sat on by big organizations.
Right.
And that's how they lose the trust. And otherwise, there just wouldn't be an audience for people.
For things like this, right.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it wouldn't be as big. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, sure. Also, I just reviewing some of her tweets. So she says, starting an outlet in which they are both reporter and editor without oversight and a subscription model that puts their material under the cloak of darkness. It is the allure of skirting these norms for quicker, dirtier reports, as well as the big money that draws them. Not only are they earning off the subscription model, many high-profile writers are paid directly by Substack to be exclusive. It's the influencer model. If having subscriptions and paywalled things is dangerous, she must be very worried about the Washington Post, the New York Times, basically every reputable outlet.
Yeah, the New York Times is almost wholly gone over to the subscription model. They have the over 7 million subscribers now, and the largest subscriber base in the world. And that's how they do their business.
Yeah. And for Matt's Substack, and you know, we'll get into this later, but for our show, it's not going to be all paywalled, for instance. And you're not all paywalled. So like, just apply the norms and standards that you claim exist, or that you claim that you want to exist, or that do exist in journalism. Just see, check it out. Do they exist? No, they don't. And again, this is very straightforward. This isn't a question of like, you know, a textual analysis. It's literally, it is a subscription-based model in the very reputable, allegedly reputable outlets that you're talking about. Also, she really suggests that there aren't conflicts of interest that happen in the corporate media.
Oh, well, we just watched one. So, John Brennan. So he's a paid contributor for MSNBC who regularly comments on stories that he himself has involvement in. And all those outlets, they're loaded with these ex-spooks who are talking about stories like Russiagate, where they were often involved, right? There's so much stuff like that that goes on.
Yeah.
And rarely disclosed.
Lest anyone think that this isn't rampant in corporate media. It is absolutely rampant. It's built into it.
Last two things I'll say about this. There's nothing that precludes doing all the things that build trust with audiences at, you know, in an independent site, right? So like one of the things that builds trust is like when you make a mistake, and you will make mistakes,
right.
You always do,
and
is you admit them,
right.
And you keep them on You keep them on the site, right? Or if you do have a conflict, you disclose it, whatever. Those are things that you're likely to do as an independent journalist, right? And you know, even if you're your own editor, you're probably going to do some kind of fact checking somehow. You might even be more nervous about it than somebody else because it'll stick to you. But the only thing that I'll say that really makes me nervous about this is all the Substack people and a lot of the people who are kind of in independent media now, none of us think that these things are panaceas, they're magic bullets that are going to fix media, which is a big problem in this country. But they can be part of a solution, right? Like this attitude that the only proper and real source of information must come from the credentialed, approved sources. It's just so funny because a long time ago, not even that long ago, when blogging first became a thing, if you remember that whole period, there was this explosion of kind of new media forms that showed up, and some of them ended up becoming big institutions like Huffington Post or the Daily Kos or whatever it is.
Kos, that's why it's called. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Once upon a time, that was a thing that people who describe themselves as liberal would have cheered, right? This whole idea, oh, we're diversifying the landscape. But now there's this general sense, I think it has a lot to do with Trump, this idea that other kinds of media that are unsupervised, are dangerous, which is, and even if they're a small piece of the landscape. So.
Right.
But anyway, crazy stuff. So, but we'll have plenty of time to talk about that on Substack. So
click, brings us through click, our pay, click, pay, subscribe, click, pay, subscribe. Yeah.
Or just click.
Yeah. Cause there's a lot of, exactly. This was a coincidence that this Substack story came out, and that has nothing to do with our leaving Rolling Stone. And or obviously this isn't like, you want to know a great parallel to Julian Assange? Obviously we're not doing that. I just realized that.
So, which brings us to our guest. Let's, without further ado, talk to Stella Morris.
Thank you so much for joining us. We know that it must be a really stressful time. So we really appreciate your giving us time. And I guess wanted to start out just talking about what the latest in the case is and what you think people should know about and can do about Julian's status, freedom, lack thereof.
Yes. So Julian actually won, against all expectations, won his extradition case at the lowest level on the 4th of January. He only won because he has a history of clinical depression and because the judge considered that there was enough medical evidence of the psychiatrists that had been assessing him and so on to conclude that extraditing him would be tantamount to applying the death penalty. But on all the other issues, there were about 8 or 9 separate legal issues about the public interest arguments. Julian lost. And what that leaves you with is that any other publisher, any other journalist that had faced the same or similar accusations of news gathering and publishing, if they don't have a history of clinical depression and the doctors don't reach the same conclusion, they are going to be extradited. They face the 175-year potential sentence, the same scenario. But there's a real risk still that Julian might be extradited because the US has decided to appeal the decision. And so that's now going to appeal. And we don't have a decision yet by the higher court, the high court it's called in the UK, as to whether it will hear the appeal. So it's now in that process, the US has lodged its arguments and the defense is lodging its counterarguments as to why the appeal should be heard or not heard.
I saw that you, after that decision, that you described weeping with joy at him winning, and forgive me, I thought that was a little odd because was it really a victory? Did you both consider it a victory? Because on another way of looking at it was that it was it sort of forestalls a decision that could lead to his freedom even faster, couldn't it? I mean, he's essentially staying in the same purgatory that he's been in. I'm just curious as to what was positive about it from your point of view.
Well, I mean, positive is and joy is an overstatement. But I mean, I had really prepared myself for an extradition order, and it came as a surprise. And we were sitting there for 45 minutes before she actually got to the point, the final point, which blocked the extradition. Mm. And so it was just a really kind of such a relief that no one was expecting. And this magistrate specifically she was extraordinarily tough during the hearings, and you know, she didn't give Julian a single concession. She didn't let him sit with his lawyers. You know, we tried to introduce evidence. She rejected it every step of the way. She appeared very biased. But when it came to the medical evidence, she actually agreed with the doctors, and also the same. Basically, the U.S. Doctors agreed with Julian's doctors. It was just a matter of degree, and so she blocked it on that basis, and that was a huge relief.
Yeah, it seems like that everyone was kind of expecting that he would be extradited, and that's what the ruling would say. And then even, like, I remember following the tweets. I think it was Kevin Gastola's tweets that I was following in real time, and you could see him, like, just by quoting the judge, everyone, it seemed like she was just going in the direction of, he's so guilty of all of these things. And then that is kind of her takeaway, but then she's like, I think Kevin tweeted, like, Julian Assange was just saved by the like cruelty of the US criminal justice system, because the judge's decision was like, but his mental health makes it that, so it's too much of a risk. So it was totally, it wasn't exonerating. I mean, and it was, I thought, like, such a problematic and terrible decision, except for that one part that I guess gave some light at the end of the tunnel, potential light.
Well, you see, the UK judges' hands are really tied when it comes to extradition. That has to do with how the extradition treaty was negotiated between the UK and the US right in the aftermath of 9/11. So it's really lopsided. And so the only thing the magistrate can do is say, these crimes in the US, if they had happened in the UK, would they be crimes here too? And she agreed with that. She said she couldn't look at any of the evidence that we had brought in, a bunch of arguments, and she said, that's her trial. You know, the defense says all these things are untrue, but I can't judge that. That's for the US. And so really, she didn't really agree in any of the points as to his guilt or the correctness of the U.S. arguments. Basically, the grand jury returns an indictment. They ship that over. The DOJ ships that over to the U.K. And then the U.K. can't question that. We weren't able to cross-examine the U.S. prosecutors on all their claims. And so what we did was we tried to bring evidence that countered their claims. But then the judge said, well, this is for trial. So really, it's just a box-ticking exercise. But I think what the judgment really reflects is a change of the political atmosphere. Julian's, you know, he was taken to Belmarsh almost 2 years ago now. Belmarsh is the, you know, highest security prison in the UK. It's a nasty place, but it's nothing compared to the US prison system, where on any given day it's estimated about 80,000 people are in solitary confinement. And then when you add to that Julian being a Julian's case being a national security case, Julian being a high profile prisoner, then of course they're going to isolate him. And then you have other layers like special administrative measures and supermax prisons. But even if you take those elements away, the very nature of the case, the fact that he's high profile, the fact that he's, you know, a risk of suicide, all these things make it a given that he's going to be in very isolated conditions.
Which is, I mean, it's pretty cruel, right? Because the UN Rapporteur on Torture has said that he's been tortured, and lots of people consider solitary confinement a form of torture. And we saw with Chelsea Manning that when she was suicidal, the like punishment was putting her in solitary, which just seems so sadistic. And it's hard to not see that as like an attempt to actually do the opposite of heal.
Right. So when they put you on suicide watch, they're basically checking you every, I don't know how many minutes, like every 15 minutes or something like that. With Chelsea Manning, she couldn't wear any clothes. So it was the humiliation on top of it. I think a lot of people don't realize what Julian's really accused of, and what the nature of the crime the US is alleging. So he's accused of publishing basically information about Bush era wars. Some of it goes into, like, it's up to 2010, early 2010 actually. So it does go into the Obama era, but it's about the Afghan war, the Iraq war, Guantanamo Bay prison camp, the US diplomatic cables, and the rules of engagement. And this is really, like, this is what WikiLeaks was set up to expose. WikiLeaks is really a product of the Bush wars, of that, the illegitimacy of those wars, and the need to expose the normalization of torture of detainees and of entering into wars with lies. And so WikiLeaks was set up to address that. And so that's what he's being prosecuted over. And WikiLeaks set up partnerships with not just the, you know, New York Times, The Guardian, and so on, but actually 100 different partners to report the substance of the cables and so on. And that material has been used in court cases and so on. And so that is what the US government under Trump decided it wants to put Julian away for life, not anything to do with anything else. And when you look at the actual accusations, they're so, like, the Espionage Act is so vaguely worded. So the US government, the DOJ, tries to put a lot of emphasis on this one charge that is conspiracy to commit computer intrusion. Now, before I even talk about the substance, what they say is the substance of that charge, if you look at the relative weight of the charges, there's 18 charges, 17 under the Espionage Act, and one under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Those 17 charges amount to 170 years. Maybe people can't really quantify that. If you think, well, I have $175, just $5 is about this conspiracy to commit computer intrusion. That's how irrelevant it is. And even the substance of it, the US says that Julian entered into an agreement to try to crack a password that would allow Chelsea Manning to hide her identity. It's not even about obtaining information, because Chelsea already had access to that information anyway, and she had already sent most of it by the time this alleged conversation took place. So, and then they have this other conspiracy charge, is like a general conspiracy, saying that WikiLeaks posted this most wanted leaks on its website, which is basically a wiki that people could, like Wikipedia, people can post things on there. It was like a general call for people to say, hey, it would be good to have the rules of engagement for these years and so on. And the US alleges that because WikiLeaks had this thing posted on its website, that Manning must have seen that and then decided to send similar things, because they don't even match up, to WikiLeaks. And that's the origin of the conspiracy. So the conspiracy, that the whole case is so, it's such a construct, it's so absurd. But that's what the Trump administration decided to drive.
I'm fascinated by the use of the Espionage Act, and it kind of boggles my mind that more reporters aren't worried about this case, about and its implications for anybody who works doing national security reporting of any kind. But there's one part that I was confused about that I was wondering if you could help with. Many of the charges are phrased like conspiracy to obtain national defense information or to receive or to publish. Does that information have to be classified? Is there a designation for what exactly is the forbidden material, or is that subjective? Can the prosecutors just decide that something is national defense information under this act? Because it seems like the act is worded to give them as much latitude as they want to prosecute anybody.
Well, it is, and I mean, I'm not a U.S. lawyer, so, but yes, it's basically information that the U.S. government says could harm national security. So it doesn't technically even have to be classified. And you don't even have to publish it. You can just possess it. And when they say communicate, they're not even saying communicating it to the public. It can be communicating within your media organization. This indictment is so dangerous. I mean, it really shifts the relationship between citizen and state. A country that can, where journalists or anyone really can report on secret government documents is completely different to one that where that is prohibited and you can go to prison if you do. And once the US goes down this road, there's no going back. And yes, I agree with you that many reporters are not fully aware of what the implications are of this indictment. But at the same time, I think the editors are. Because if you look at Marty Baron from the Washington Post and the New York Times editorial board, and I think USA Today and others, The Guardian too, like at the editorial level, they've put out statements saying this is really dangerous. This is chilling the free press. And I think they're doing that because they're receiving stories and they're saying, actually, we can't publish this. And the reason we can't publish this is because of the Assange indictment. When they're putting out those statements, it's because they're already coming up against that that wall. So imagine how many stories we don't know about as long as this is ongoing, until the Biden administration drops this, which it must, then that's a new reality. It's not about, you know, the Assange indictment risks, you know, maybe threatening the free press. It is already having that effect, and that's why there's a consensus really by all the major free press organizations that are against this, Amnesty International and so on. They see it, because anyone who really looks into this it's really quite clear.
There are a lot of other questions that I think both of us have about the ramifications of the treatment of Julian. But can you talk about your background, how you met first through legal matters and then how your relationship evolved?
Yeah, sure. I met Julian in 2011 because Jennifer Robinson, who's one of the lawyers representing Julian in the UK, sent an email around to her network. And I received this email and I found, you know, WikiLeaks and the whole WikiLeaks story fascinating. I had first come across WikiLeaks in 2008, I think, because I was writing about East Timor at the time, and they had published some, you know, interesting things about East Timor. And then I remember seeing Pull Out of Murder in when it came out in April 2010, and finding this, you know, really disturbing. And I cried when I saw that, and I still cry every time I see it. And I think for people who were, you know, politically aware in 2010, and even, you know, people my age who maybe marched in the Iraq marches to stop the war and so on, that video was so significant because it kind of confirmed, you know, it was like we tried to stop the war, we couldn't stop the war, and then this was the evidence of how the US was. There were war crimes and there was impunity, and this is the evidence. And the US, like the countries, really need the legitimacy of their population to wage wars, because, you know, we pay for it. And so once they lose that, it becomes really intractable for them. So this was like, yeah, we can actually expose what's going on and that will have consequences. So I think it was a really kind of hopeful moment for many people who had opposed the Iraq war, that WikiLeaks was able to kind of get past the inertia in the public debate around the Iraq war.
And just so people know, it's a video that captures basically war crimes that committed by the U.S. military. It's video footage of it, and they kills members of the press, among other people, right?
Yeah. So it's, I mean, anyone who hasn't seen that video has to go and see it. It's like, you know, Kristen Crapson, the editor of WikiLeaks, says that that video is to the Iraq war what the Vietnam, the girl, the girl that's burnt with napalm, the picture of the girl in Vietnam is to the, Vietnam War. So it's such a powerful video because you're just kind of observing what the US helicopter was seeing. And then you find out that these, I mean, you can see there was no provocation or anything. These were just civilians. And two of them happened to be Reuters journalists. And they're just massacred on the ground, and then there's a good Samaritan that goes to rescue them, and then he also gets gunned down, and his two children are severely wounded. So that video was really like wow, I remember that very clearly, and I happened to watch that with a friend of mine who had been in the military, who had been a fighter jet pilot, and he said, well, actually, I've seen lots of these videos. This happens all the time. And I found that really shocking. But that was almost a whole year before I met Julian. And so Jennifer Robinson got her email, and then I just came to London because I wasn't living in London at the time, and met Julian. I think it was around the time of his court dates, and his extradition hearings to Sweden were already underway, and that's kind of the context in which I first got involved, because I'm Swedish, part Swedish, speak Swedish, and so on. And I looked into that case and seen that, you know, it was highly politicized from the start. And I had been following things in Sweden. I had read the police reports and so on. And I could see that this was, you know, the whole, there was an abusive process from the beginning, and that's undeniable. And the UN basically looked into it and concluded the same thing in the end. The whole investigation fell apart for this very reason, because it was really just incredibly abusive and basically created a legal limbo for Julian, where he wasn't charged, where he didn't have rights as a defendant, where, you know, basically creating this public uncertainty around what was going on. That obscured what was really going on, which was the US case brewing in the background, and all this political pressure on Sweden and the UK at the time.
It also created what Matt, you call this the ick factor. Well, you can explain it better, Matt, because you came up with that phrase, but not reflecting him, but reflecting the way that he's presented and treated, right?
Yeah, I mean, we have this thing basically where if there's enough negative publicity about somebody, people will become hesitant to advocate for them. They'll become hesitant to want to be connected to them and publicly. There'll be fewer op-eds in somebody's defense. And, you know, we've seen that a lot in recent times, but particularly in Julian's case, I think, especially since 2016. I mean, I think that
I mean, I think there's like there's a bit of a myth about, you know, at some point, everyone loved Julian. I think that the media didn't like Julian, like the New York Times. The WikiLeaks publications were so explosive and so significant that the New York Times teamed up with WikiLeaks, but almost immediately distanced themselves. And that was because WikiLeaks really revolutionized journalism, and they realized that actually their days were numbered and they had to transform. So WikiLeaks, basically Julian pioneered the anonymous Dropbox, because he's a cryptographer to begin with. So he was able to think about the problems of source protection in a different way to, you know, non-cryptographic experts who might not quite have understood at the time how the internet was, you know, tracking everyone, and it was impossible to anonymize people. And also pioneered this kind of collaboration that now, you know, I think the ICIJ and others are also doing. They didn't want to collaborate, like the New York Times, the Guardian, you know, they're all competitors. And so here came Julian, this Australian kind of outsider, who had these new ideas and new implementations and got these explosive leaks. And I think there was a lot of jealousy there. And because he was elevated, there was a lot of interest around his person as well. But there has definitely been a smear campaign. And I think the hopeful thing is that the smear campaign is all based on lies, you know. Once it's based on anything true, then you have to worry. But you just see what happened after 2016. There were so many stories that had to be retracted because they were just churning out complete fabrications. The most famous one is the Paul Manafort visiting the embassy on three different occasions, which was a complete fabrication. And The Guardian published it on its front page, even though they kind of had already, by the time, like, the in its print edition, I mean, by the time the print went out, it was already clear that this was a highly suspect story. I think that the interesting thing about the Manafort story is that, yes, they put it out and they went all out, and, you know, everyone who was on Twitter, it was just exploding, like, this is the
smoking gun,
this changes everything kind of thing. And then it, you know, immediately just fell apart because it was a lie, and it couldn't be corroborated by anyone. And I think the Washington Post put out two articles about how this was an embarrassment. And the Guardian basically retracted it almost immediately. Like they said, they changed the headline to, you know, Manafort visited three times, and then within an hour or two, they said, some people say, kind of thing. So, I mean, they haven't taken it off their website, but they don't really think it's true. And I think even the author, Luke Harding, he's written I don't know how many books about Russiagate, and even in his own book, he doesn't mention that story, which was supposedly to be this, like, really explosive thing. But it's just one example of many, many stories that came out after 2016. And really, like, when you look at the Mueller report, which they decided to unredact the part about WikiLeaks, I think the day before the 2020 elections, basically they found no evidence. There was no evidence to say there was any collusion. That was the conclusion, but you don't hear that because, you know, these things are just, it's just positional. People don't really care about the truth sometimes. They want to project a position. And so that's, it's frustrating. But I mean, I think it's quite clear to everyone really what's going on now. And that they're after Julian because he exposed US war crimes, and they want to send a signal.
This ties into what you were saying before about the resentment and the jealousy. You think they're making an example out of him to deter not just people in established journalism like the USA Today and the Washington Post, but anybody else who might think about doing it, you know, on their own?
What they've done is very dangerous. They've said that Julian, so, you know, the DOJ says, well, he's not a journalist. which is irrelevant legally because the First Amendment doesn't just protect journalists, it protects everyone. That's the whole point of it. It restrains Congress from attempting to limit speech, right? And so it's a very dangerous situation when you have a government trying to say who is and who isn't a journalist. Besides, if anyone has a claim to being a journalist, it's Julian, because he's won dozens of journalism prizes and he's been a member of his journalist union since 2007 and so on. What they're also doing is creating a really dangerous situation even for established journalists in the US, not just because, yes, they're exposed to being prosecuted as well by the US, but because, look, in Julian's case, he's not American. WikiLeaks wasn't operating out of the US. He was publishing in the UK in collaboration with other European publishers, yes, also the New York Times and so on. But there's no, like, the jurisdiction is just what he was publishing about the US, and maybe some people were reading in the US, but also the rest of the world. So this means, you know, US journalists, for example, CNN was published the Wuhan files in December, I think, let's say that they're classified or restricted or whatever. You know, the Chinese government can now go, well, actually, under our secrecy laws, you are violating our secrecy laws. And I don't care that you're not Chinese. I don't care that you weren't in China. You were in the US and we can extradite you. And okay, maybe the US won't extradite a journalist on those grounds. But what if that journalist is in, I don't know, some country that is friendlier to China, and like China, you know, take any country can do this. So basically the US leads by example for good and for bad, and now it's created a really terrible standard with Julian that puts freedom of the press globally in a very bad situation.
I know that it's hard to go back and forth, but I just wanted to return to the personal, because it is political, right? And I guess if you could just explain your personal relationship, but also why you decided, how, when, why, where you decided to reveal that.
Yeah, so I mean, I've known Julian for a decade, right? When we got together, he was already in the embassy for a few years. And
you were a lawyer at this point?
Yeah, for his international legal team, working with his coordinator for the international legal team, Baltazar Garzon in Spain. But I was working out of the UK. And I was, in the embassy practically every day. And the embassy was some kind of strange, Julian referred to it as a spaceship. I mean, it's really, I think people now can relate a little bit more to,
right, 'cause COVID.
To a bit like how, yeah, you kind of lose track of time. And at the same time, there was a lot going on. Like there was, you know, things you couldn't anticipate, like WikiLeaks published this publication called Hacking Team in 2014. And it contained evidence that the Ecuadorian government had been spying on environmental groups, and it made the intelligence service look really bad. And then so the Ecuadorian intelligence service then became hostile, and you know, just things you couldn't anticipate, crises just appearing out of nowhere. And it was, you know, the situation in the embassy was pretty good for a long time, with some, you know, it's always going to be difficult.
Right.
But up until 2017, and that is when the security company basically cut a deal with Las Vegas Sands, which I know you've spoken to Max Blumenthal about, but basically Las Vegas Sands, owned by Sheldon Adelson, Trump's biggest financial backer.
R.I.P. You know,
R.I.P. The guy that stood, you know, who is in the shot, like when Trump was being inaugurated, he's right next to Trump. That guy, he's a casino was mogul, who was also Las Vegas Sands, actually has been documented cooperating with the CIA in Macau. Some court documents were published by The Guardian a few years ago. So there's a collaboration there, and Las Vegas Sands had a secret contract with this security company that was in the embassy, and they were basically spying on us from mid-2017, but it really intensified around Christmas 2017.
And by this point, so 2017, you had been in a romantic relationship with Julian right. for 2 years at that point? It started in 2015, is that correct?
Yeah, for about 2 years. Yeah, and the embassy is like, it's the size of an apartment, not, you know, I don't know if you use meters, about 200 square meters. There were cameras everywhere. So not a very private space, but I don't know, you just
make do.
You make do, you know, like there's always room for romance.
Right.
I mean, I'm sure you've seen images from inside the embassy. It was tiny, and the corridors and most of the spaces had visible cameras. And then also there were microphones, and there were probably cameras that I didn't know about, and I'm still kind of dreading, you know, other videos to come, but maybe they won't.
WikiLeaks will have to publish. Yeah. Right.
Exactly.
And so you have, and I understand this is like very private and you're a very private person. You have two children who are adorable, and sorry, I always apologize to moms because you guys do the labor, but they look so much like Julian. I'm sure you're there too. I see some resemblance in the smaller one, the younger one, but it's like the older one, especially, it's like a spitting image. I watched a video interview with you, and there was a kind of, it seems like a watershed moment for you where a Spanish guard came up to you and told you something. And that I think shifted the way you decided to act and what you decided to do. Could you recall that moment and what it was?
Yeah. So basically, I mean, I only came out as, you know, Julian's partner a year ago, and had to reveal that we had two children together and we were engaged and all these things. And I had managed to keep this from the wider public. And it's not anything I recommend trying to hide two pregnancies. I basically wore lots of baggy clothes, and, you know, I'm quite short. So, you know, you also can't hide growing.
Right.
I did hide it from the embassy staff as well. I just avoided going there during office hours. The guards obviously suspected, everyone suspected. But I thought, as long as they can't confirm I'm pregnant, then we'll just see how we manage and how far we get. So I had Gabriel, our oldest, in 2017. And basically there was no way around it. I had to bring Gabriel to the embassy because that's the only way he'd be able to see his father and vice versa. And so I recruited a friend to bring the baby in as his own. And my friend went there as a Chinese teacher and brought his baby along, his baby. And we did this for a good, I don't know, 6 months maybe. But then in December 2017, one of the UC Global guards approached me and took me aside and said, you know, we've been instructed, we've been told to get that baby's DNA, and it would be better if the baby doesn't come in anymore because, you know, it's not safe. They're asking us to do very strange things.
What kind of strange things?
Basically, the DNA, they were instructed to steal a nappy, a diaper, I think you say. Yeah, a diaper. And if they couldn't get the diaper, then to get the dummy, the pacifier, to confirm the DNA, to confirm the paternity, which means they already had Julian's DNA.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's right. Can't you not tell from, like, stool samples?
Right.
I mean, anyway, like, that's not a thing.
Yeah. No, I think they, I, they weren't at that level.
Yeah.
At that
intelligence
point.
Intelligence, yeah.
Yeah. But then we also found out that they had afterwards, one of the UC Global workers, then, or a couple, then went to the press, to El País, and explained more of what they had been doing there. They had been recording the meetings Julian was having with his lawyers. There were plots to kidnap Julian out of the embassy. There was even a plot to poison Julian. They were going to poison his food and put it in the fridge, but they relented because they thought the fridge had a camera in it. Basically, that environment inside the embassy was really, really dangerous, and we could really feel it. I mean, imagine being in a closed space with people who are literally plotting to kill you, plotting to steal your baby's, you know, DNA, and you could just feel it, that this was a really dangerous environment, and that you were basically at the mercy of some really bad people, and you didn't know the exact shape of it, but there was just this atmosphere of threat. And you know, thankfully, people have come forward to bring the specifics. And then we've known the connection to Adelson, because we didn't know that. We just felt like this was a dangerous environment. And Adelson, you know, was very close to Trump.
I know we've kept you on for a long time. I only have sort of one last compound question for you. The first one is just, how is his health right now? How is he feeling? And the second is, you know, going forward, what's your primary hope for the best case scenario? Is it political pressure on the Biden administration that they will eventually drop the case? Is it winning in court in the United States or winning in England? I'm just curious what you're hoping for. What the best resolution that you can imagine would be.
He's been in Belmarsh prison for almost 2 years. It will be 2 years in April. You know, it's really tough because he's a person that needs a lot of stimulation, intellectual stimulation. He's surrounded by, occasional interesting criminals, but criminals nonetheless. And also many of them very dangerous criminals and some psychotic murderers, literally. So he was denied bail, but I'm hoping that a UK court will allow bail. But really, like, the best case scenario is the UK High Court says, we don't want to listen, we don't want to hear this appeal, this is over. And that could happen. I mean, it could happen by April, really. More likely scenario is that this will go, that the appeal will be allowed, because generally they do allow appeals. And hopefully it will uphold the decision in the lower court, and that will be it. But that won't make the indictment go away. And so what needs to happen is for the Biden administration to see some sense and stop this, drop the charges. Look, the Obama administration, they looked into this, and the conclusion there by the end of the Obama administration was, we're not going to bring an indictment against Assange, and we're going to commute Chelsea Manning's sentence. That was a clear political signal that they were putting this to bed. And that was the result of, you know, a strong campaign to get Chelsea's, you know, 35-year sentence commuted. And that was successful. Then what happened? The Trump administration came in, and Trump's administration, very unwillingly, was probably the most transparent U.S. administration there's been in history, because there were leaks, there were constant leaks, there were leaks of Trump's, you know, phone conversations with foreign leaders and all sorts of things. And the Trump administration's decision to indict Julian was a means to an end, and that end was to find a way to prosecute journalists. And so if you look at the Obama administration, basically the reason they gave for not prosecuting Julian was, well, there were two. One was Matthew Miller, the former DOJ spokesperson. He said on several occasions, the Obama administration has decided not to indict Assange because he's not a hacker. He didn't participate in any criminality obtaining this material. And so basically the Obama administration said there's a New York Times problem, which is you can't indict Assange without this also setting a precedent for the New York Times. And so what happened under Trump? Under Trump, they said, well, indicting Assange is actually the New York Times solution. We want to prosecute journalists. We want to be able, we want to have the option of prosecuting the New York Times because they're leaking things about the administration all the time. So how do we do that? Well, we indict Assange. And of course, WikiLeaks, one of the first things that WikiLeaks did as soon as Trump was in office was publish the biggest CIA leak in history, Vault 7. And then, you know, the whole intelligence security establishment was pressing down on Trump to, like, basically cheering him on to do this. And so now you have the Biden administration. Now, Biden was in both Obama's administration, and the message he's pushing is a return to sanity, right? A return to an independent Department of Justice. And, well, if he's going to be consequent with that, presumably the Department of Justice that was independent was the one under Obama's administration. And the logical thing to do there would be to return to the Obama administration's policy, which is not to indict Julian and to drop all the charges. I don't read too much into the fact that they haven't appealed, that they've proceeded with the appeal, because that's kind of the fallback, right?
It's right. Default.
Yeah, the default. There's a UK deadline for the courts to appeal, so they appealed. And there's an acting attorney general, Merrick Garland, is not yet in. This is an important, very high profile case. This is basically for the attorney general to decide. And so it's really important, I think, now for people to continue to write articles, campaign for the Biden administration to drop the charges, because it will be up to Merrick Garland. And also the other top posts of the DOJ are also still to be filled.
Right.
And so there's still a lot of time for a policy decision to be made, looking at the dangers of this case. And so it's important for the people to continue to write and campaign and argue and expose why this indictment is so dangerous. And I will say this as well, it's quite interesting. I've just been looking into this a little bit, but how Trump's administration was really overrepresented by people who were associated with this place called the Catholic Information Center in DC, Barr, Dwyer, the White House counsel, and others. And those people are now gone. So I think there was a network of people that are now gone, and there's a new set of people coming in. And so there's an opportunity for there to be a break.
Yeah. Yeah. Back to normal, guys. Biden has two choices. He can go the Obama route or the Trump route. So everyone, you know, this is very excited to have Biden go the Obama route. Just got to drop it. Really last question for me. How do you talk about this with your kids? How old are they now? And how do you explain to them what's happening to their dad?
They're 2 and 3, so they're still very young. And so the older one is turning 4 soon. And so I have to explain a little more. But so far, they speak to their dad over the phone, and they haven't seen him since October. But before COVID, we would go to the prison a few times a week. I don't talk about it being a prison because I don't want them to interiorize the fact that their father's in a prison, because that's where bad people go, right? So I don't have a solution to how I'm going to explain it to them, but hopefully he'll be free before I have to.
All right.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. We wish you luck, and we're hoping that everybody comes to their senses sooner rather than later in this case.
Thanks.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
All right. That was great.
Disturbing, important.
Yeah.
moving, sad, infuriating, scary. I saw your face, Matt, when she was telling that story about like how they tried to get the kids' diapers.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's a little bit Keystone Cops.
Yeah.
But it's like almost everything else in life, like the absurdity was always matched by the cruelty. You know what I mean? When you have people who are doing something this outrageous,
right?
There's always an absurdity factor that somehow is matched by the cruelty of it.
Yeah. And what's so interesting also is that all the things that Assange and WikiLeaks exposed are proven and demonstrated in the media's treatment of Assange.
Absolutely. The failure of all these mainstream news organizations to kind of stand up in this situation, it's basically a total capitulation and an admission that they've abandoned their adversarial mission completely.
Yeah. Also, something we didn't mention, I forgot to mention, is that, you know, there were journalists who know, and we talked about this with Stefania Morizzi, you know, journalists who knew that they were spied on have not done anything about it. Who know that they were spied on, had their cell phones, you know, their battery taken out, whatever. Like, there's a real problem. And again, less you need more evidence of the corporate media not doing its job and not protecting democracy, free press. I mean, these are everyone, no matter what you think politically, the fact that there is not like outrage, the fact that people are not up in arms at the New York Times, The Guardian, Washington Post, the fact that this isn't front page news is just such a sign of the absolute like...
Oh, it's a sign of their complete rollover.
Yeah.
You know, because they just don't picture themselves. If you go back to the Pentagon Papers days, where the New York Times, it was really interested in flexing its own institutional muscle, right? Like, let's see exactly how far we can push this, and we're not afraid, and all of that. And that has completely been reversed in this modern age.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with what you might feel about Julian Assange personally. This is just the whole issue of, you know, they're gonna pass a law that's gonna make it basically illegal to do national security reporting.
Yeah.
And okay, and they just say okay, you know, which is crazy. So
on the plus side, the former CIA directors will be checking their white male privilege. So there's that.
That's good. Yeah, I guess it's probably a net plus in the end.
Yeah. So. Yeah. But seriously, get over your. I don't care what you think about Julian Assange's personality. It has nothing to do with it. And like. Everyone who cares about free press, everyone who hates Donald Trump for like, you know, his attacks on media should be up in arms about this.
Well, this is the worst thing he did to the media, and it's going to be continued by the Biden administration and nobody cares. So anyway. Yeah.
Way to side with Trump over Obama, Joe.
So that's it. That's the end of our run at Rolling Stone. And it's been a lot of fun. We are eternally grateful to the great magazine. And thank you so much.
Thank you so much. But it's not a goodbye. Let's not be dramatic. I mean, we're saying goodbye to Rolling Stone, but to our audience.
We'll meet again. Right? Yeah. It's like that. Yeah, yeah.
To our audience, it's come on board to the next chapter. This is the next chapter. I'm very excited. It's a whole brave new world out there. And where can they find us again, Matt?
At usefulidiots.substack.com.
Yeah.
So thank you very much.
Thank you to Dan. Reed, Elvis, Sheermag,
and all the rest, and we'll see you again.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a PS to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the PS first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.